This audiobook provided courtesy of www.paradisetbc.org.
Against a Pit on Book 1. Part 1. I suppose that by my books of the antiquity of the Jews, most excellent Epaphroditus, have made it evident to those who peruse them, that our Jewish nation is of very great antiquity, and had a distinct subsistence of its own originally, as also, I have therein declared how we came to inhabit this country, wherein we now live. Those antiquities contain the history of 5,000 years, and are taken out of our sacred books, but are translated by me into the Greek tongue. However, since I observe a considerable number of people giving ear to the reproaches that are laid against us by those who bear ill will to us, and will not believe what I have written concerning the antiquity of our nation, while they take it for a plain sign that our nation is of a late date, because they are not so much as vouchsafed to bear mention by the most famous historiographers among the Grecians. I therefore have thought myself under an obligation to write somewhat briefly about these subjects, in order to convict those that reproach us of spite and voluntary falsehood, and to correct the ignorance of others, and withal to instruct all those who are desirous of knowing the truth of what great antiquity we really are. As for the witnesses whom I shall produce for the proof of what I say, they shall be such as are esteemed to be of the greatest reputation for truth, and the most skillful in the knowledge of all antiquity by the Greeks themselves. I will also show that those who have written so reproachfully and falsely about us are to be convicted by what they have written themselves to the contrary. I shall also endeavor to give an account of the reasons why it hath so happened that there have not been a great number of Greeks who have made mention of our nation in their histories. I will, however, bring those Grecians to light who have not omitted such our history, for the sake of those that either do not know them, or pretend not to know them already. And now, in the first place, I cannot but greatly wonder at those men who suppose that we must attend to none but Grecians when we are inquiring about the most ancient facts, and must inform ourselves of their truth from them only, while we must not believe ourselves nor other men, for I am convinced that the very reverse is the truth of the case. I mean this, if we will not be led by vain opinions, but will make inquiry after truth from facts themselves, for they will find that almost all which concerns the Greeks happened not long ago, nay, one may say, is of yesterday only. I speak of the building of their cities, the inventions of their arts, and the description of their laws, and, as for their care about the writing down of their histories, it is very near the last thing they set about. However, they acknowledge themselves so far that they were the Egyptians, the Chaldeans, and the Phoenicians, for I will not now reckon ourselves among them, that have preserved the memorials of the most ancient and most lasting traditions of mankind. For almost all these nations inhabit such countries as are least subject to destruction from the world about them, and these also have taken especial care to have nothing omitted of what was remarkably done among them, but their history was esteemed sacred, and put into public tables, as written by men of the greatest wisdom they had among them. But as for the place where the Grecians inhabit, 10,000 destructions have overtaken it, and blotted out the memory of former actions, so that they were ever beginning a new way of living, and supposed that every one of them was the origin of their new state. It was also late, and with difficulty, that they came to know the letters they now use, for those who would advance their use of these letters to the greatest antiquity pretend that they learned them from the Phoenicians, and from Cadmus, yet is nobody able to demonstrate that they have any writing preserved from that time, neither in their temples, nor in any other public monuments. This appears because the time when those lived who went to the Trojan War, so many years afterward, is in great doubt, and great inquiry is made, whether the Greeks used their letters at that time, and the most prevailing opinion, and that nearest the truth, is that their present way of using those letters was unknown at that time. However, there is not any writing which the Greeks agree to hege in among them ancienter than Homer's poems, who must plainly he confessed later than the siege of Troy. Nay, the report goes that even he did not leave his poems in writing, but that their memory was preserved in songs, and they were put together afterward, and that this is the reason of such a number of variations as are found in them. As for those who set themselves about writing their histories, I mean such as Cadmus of Miletus, and Acucilus of Argos, and any others that may be mentioned, as succeeding Acucilus, they lived but a little while before the Persian expedition into Greece. But then for those that first introduced philosophy, and the consideration of things celestial and divine among them, such as for Cades the Syrian, and Pythagoras, and Thales, all with one consent agree, that they learned what they knew of the Egyptians and Chaldeans, and wrote but little, and these are the things which are supposed to be the oldest of all among the Greeks, and they have much ado to believe that the writings ascribed to those men are genuine. How can it then be other than an absurd thing for the Greeks to be so proud, and to vaunt themselves to be the only people that are acquainted with antiquity, and that have delivered the true accounts of those early times, after an accurate manner? Nay, who is there that cannot easily gather from the Greek writers themselves, that they knew but little on any good foundation, when they set to write, but rather wrote their histories from their own conjectures? Accordingly, they confute one another in their own books to purpose, and are not ashamed to give us the most contradictory accounts of the same things, and I should spend my time to little purpose, if I should pretend to teach the Greeks that which they know better than I already, what a great disagreement there is between Hellenicus and Acucilus about their genealogies, in how many eases Acucilus corrects Hesiod, or after what manner Ephorus demonstrates Hellenicus to have told lies in the greatest part of his history, as does Timaeus, in like manner, as to Ephorus, and the succeeding writers do to Timaeus, and all the later writers do to Herodotus, nor could Timaeus agree with Antiochus and Philistius, or with Callias, about the Sicilian history, no more than do the several writers of the Avite follow one another about the Athenian affairs, nor do the historians the like, that wrote the Argolics, about the affairs of the Argives. And now what need I say any more about particular cities, and smaller places, while in the most approved writers of the expedition of the Persians, and of the actions which were therein performed, there are so great differences? Nay, Thucydides himself is accused of some as writing what is false, although he seems to have given us the exactest history of the affairs of his own time. As for the occasions of so great disagreement of theirs, there may be assigned many that are very probable, if any have a mind to make an inquiry about them, but I ascribe these contradictions chiefly to two causes, which I will now mention, and still think what I shall mention in the first place to be the principal of all. For if we remember that in the beginning the Greeks had taken no care to have public records of their several transactions preserved, this must for certain have afforded those that would afterward write about those ancient transactions the opportunity of making mistakes, and the power of making lies also, for this original recording of such ancient transactions hath not only been neglected by the other states of Greece, but even among the Athenians themselves also, who pretend to be aborigines, and to have applied themselves to learning. There are no such records extant, nay, they say themselves that the laws of Draco concerning murders, which are now extant in writing, are the most ancient of their public records, which Draco yet lived but a little before the tyrant Pisistratus. For as to the Arcadians, who make such boasts of their antiquity, what need I speak of them in particular, since it was still later before they got their letters, and learned them, and that with difficulty also. There must therefore naturally arise great differences among writers, when they had no original records to lay for their foundation, which might at once inform those who had an inclination to learn, and contradict those that would tell lies. However, we are to suppose a second occasion, besides the former of these contradictions, it is this, that those who were the most zealous to write history were not solicitous for the discovery of truth, although it was very easy for them always to make such a profession, but their business was to demonstrate that they could write well, and make an impression upon mankind thereby, and in what manner of writing they thought they were able to exceed others, to that did they apply themselves. Some of them took themselves to the writing of fabulous narrations, some of them endeavored to please the cities, or the kings, by writing in their commendation. Others of them fell to finding faults with transactions, or with the writers of such transactions, and thought to make a great figure by so doing. And indeed these do what is of all things the most contrary to true history, for it is the great character of true history, that all concerned therein both speak, and write the same things, while these men, by writing differently about the same things, think they shall be believed to write with the greatest regard to truth. We therefore who are Jews must yield to the Grecian writers, as to language and eloquence of composition, but then we shall give them no such preference, as to the verity of ancient history, and least of all as to that part which concerns the affairs of our own several countries. As to the care of writing down the records from the earliest antiquity among the Egyptians and Babylonians, that the priests were entrusted therewith, and employed a philosophical concern about it, that they were the Chaldean priests that did so among the Babylonians, and that the Phoenicians, who were mingled among the Greeks, did especially make use of their letters, both for the common affairs of life, and for the delivering down the history of common transactions, I think I may omit any proof. Because all men allow it so to be. But now, as to our forefathers, that they took no less care about writing such records, for I will not say they took greater care, and the others I spoke of, and that they committed that matter to their high priests, and to their prophets, and that these records have been written all along down to our own times with the utmost accuracy, nay, if it be not too bold for me to say it, our history will be so written hereafter, I shall endeavor briefly to inform you. For our forefathers did not only appoint the best of these priests, and those that attended upon the divine worship.
Be sure and visit www.paradisepbc.org and find many more study resources and MP3 audio files.
Part 2. And now I shall add Menander the Ephesian, as an additional witness. This Menander wrote the acts that were done both by the Greeks and barbarians, under every one of the Tyrian kings, and had taken much pains to learn their history out of their own records. Now when he was writing about those kings that had reigned at Tyre, he came to Hiram, and says thus, upon the death of Abibalus, his son Hiram took the kingdom. He lived 53 years, and reigned 34. He raised a bank on that called the Broad Place, and dedicated that golden pillar which is in Jupiter's temple. He also went and cut down timber from the mountain called Libanus, and got timber of cedar for the roofs of the temples. He also pulled down the old temples, and built new ones. Besides this, he consecrated the temples of Hercules and of Astarte. He first built Hercules's temple in the month Pirithous, and that of Astarte, when he made his expedition against the Titians, who would not pay him their tribute, and when he had subdued them to himself, he returned home. Under this king there was a younger son of Abdemon, who mastered the problems which Solomon king of Jerusalem had recommended to be solved. Now the time from this king to the building of Carthage is thus calculated. Upon the death of Hiram, Belisarius his son took the kingdom. He lived 43 years, and reigned 7 years. After him succeeded his son Abdastartus. He lived 29 years, and reigned 9 years. Now 4 sons of his nurse plotted against him and slew him, the eldest of whom reigned 12 years. After them came Astartus, the son of Delastartus. He lived 54 years, and reigned 12 years. After him came his brother Aserimus. He lived 54 years, and reigned 9 years. He was slain by his brother Phelus, who took the kingdom, and reigned but 8 months. Though he lived 50 years, he was slain by Atobalus, the priest of Astarte, who reigned 32 years, and lived 68 years. He was succeeded by his son Bodazarus, who lived 45 years, and reigned 6 years. He was succeeded by Machinus his son. He lived 32 years, and reigned 9 years. Pygmalion succeeded him. He lived 56 years, and reigned 47 years. Now in the 7th year of his reign, his sister fled away from him, and built the city Carthage in Libya. So the whole time from the reign of Hiram till the building of Carthage amounts to the sum of 155 years and 8 months. Since then the temple was built at Jerusalem. In the 12th year of the reign of Hiram, there were from the building of the temple until the building of Carthage 143 years and 8 months. Wherefore, what occasion is there for alleging any more testimonies out of the Phoenician histories on the behalf of our nation, since what I have said is so thoroughly confirmed already? And to be sure, our ancestors came into this country long before the building of the temple, for it was not till we had gotten possession of the whole land by war that we built our temple. And this is the point that I have clearly proved out of our secret writings in my Antiquities. I will now relate what hath been written concerning us in the Chaldean histories, which records have a great agreement with our books in oilier things also. Berozus shall be witness to what I say. He was by birth a Chaldean, well known by the learned, on account of his publication of the Chaldean books of astronomy and philosophy among the Greeks. This Berozus, therefore, following the most ancient records of that nation, gives us a history of the deluge of waters that then happened, and of the destruction of mankind thereby, and agrees with Moses's narration thereof. He also gives us an account of that ark, wherein Noah, the origin of our race, was preserved, when it was brought to the highest part of the Armenian mountains, after which he gives us a catalogue of the posterity of Noah, and adds the years of their chronology, and at length comes down to Nabal-Assar, who was king of Babylon, and of the Chaldeans. And when he was relating the acts of this king, he describes to us how he sent his son Nabuchodonosor against Egypt, and against our land, with a great army, upon his being informed that they had revolted from him, and how, by that means, he subdued them all, and set our temple, that was at Jerusalem, on fire. Nay, and removed our people entirely out of their own country, and transferred them to Babylon, when it so happened that our city was desolate during the interval of 70 years, until the days of Cyrus king of Persia. He then says that this Babylonian king conquered Egypt, and Syria, and Phoenicia, and Arabia, and exceeded in his exploits all that had reigned before him in Babylon and Chaldea. A little after which Berozah subjoins what follows in his History of Ancient Times. I will set down Berozah's own accounts, which are these: when Nabolassar, father of Nabuchodonosor, heard that the governor, whom he had set over Egypt, and over the parts of Celesyria and Phoenicia, had revolted from him, he was not able to bear it any longer, but committing certain parts of his army to his son Nabuchodonosor, who was then but young, he sent him against the rebel. Nabuchodonosor joined battle with him, and conquered him, and reduced the country under his dominion again. Now it so fell out that his father Nabolassar fell into a distemper at this time, and died in the city of Babylon, after he had reigned 29 years. But as he understood, in a little time, that his father Nabolassar was dead, he set the affairs of Egypt, and the other countries in order, and committed the captives he had taken from the Jews, and Phoenicians, and Syrians, and of the nations belonging to Egypt, to some of his friends, that they might conduct that part of the forces, that had on heavy armor, with the rest of his baggage, to Babylonia, while he went in haste, having but a few with him, over the desert to Babylon, whither, when he was come, he found the public affairs had been managed by the Chaldeans, and that the principal person among them had preserved the kingdom for him. Accordingly, he now entirely obtained all his father's dominions. He then came, and ordered the captives to be placed as colonies in the most proper places of Babylonia, but for himself, he adorned the temple of Belus, and the other temples, after an elegant manner, out of the spoils he had taken in this war. He also rebuilt the old city, and added another to it on the outside, and so far restored Babylon, that none who should besiege it afterwards might have it in their power to divert the river, so as to facilitate an entrance into it, and this he did by building 3 walls about the inner city, and 3 about the outer. Some of these walls he built of burnt brick and bitumen, and some of brick only. So when he had thus fortified the city with walls, after an excellent manner, and had adorned the gates magnificently, he added a new palace, to that which his father had dwelt in, and disclosed by it also, and that more eminent in its height, and in its great splendor. It would perhaps require too long a narration, if any one were to describe it. However, as prodigiously large and as magnificent as it was finished in 15 days. Now in this palace he erected very high walks, supported by stone pillars, and by planting what was called a pencil paradise, and replenishing it with all sorts of trees, he rendered the prospect an exact resemblance of a mountainous country. This he did to please his queen, because she had been brought up in Media, and was fond of a mountainous situation. This is what Berozas relates concerning the forementioned king, as he relates many other things about him also in the 3rd book of his Chaldean history, wherein he complains of the Grecian writers, for supposing, without any foundation, that Babylon was built by Semiramis, queen of Assyria, and for her false pretense to those wonderful edifices their 2 buildings at Babylon do no way contradict those ancient, and relating, as if they were her own workmanship, as indeed in these affairs the Chaldean history cannot but be the most credible. Moreover, we meet with a confirmation of what Berozah says in the archives of the Phoenicians concerning this king Nabuchodonosor, that he conquered all Syria and Phoenicia, in which case Philostratus agrees with the others in that history which he composed, where he mentions the siege of Tyre, as does Megasthenes also, in the 4th book of his Indian history, wherein he pretends to prove that the forementioned king of the Babylonians was superior to Hercules in strength, and the greatness of his exploits. For he says that he conquered a great part of Libya, and conquered Iberia also. Now as to what I have said before about the temple at Jerusalem, that it was fought against by the Babylonians, and burnt by them, but was opened again when Cyrus had taken the kingdom of Asia, shall now be demonstrated from what bearers has asked further upon that head, for thus he says in his third book, Nabuchodonosor, after he had begun to build the forementioned wall, fell sick, and departed this life, when he had reigned 43 years, whereupon his son Evil-Merodach obtained the kingdom. He governed public affairs after an illegal and impure manner, and had the plot laid against him by Nergal-Sir, his sister's husband, and was slain by him, when he had reigned but 2 years. After he was slain, Nergal-Sir, the person who plotted against him, succeeded him in the kingdom, and reigned 4 years. His son Labrisar had obtained the kingdom, though he was but a child, and kept it 9 months, but by reason of the very ill temper and ill practices he exhibited to the world, a plot was laid against him also by his friends, and he was tormented to death. After his death, the conspirators got together, and by common consent put the crown upon the head of Nabonidus, a man of Babylon, and one who belonged to that insurrection. In his reign it was that the walls of the city of Babylon were curiously built with burnt brick and bitumen, but when he was come to the 17th year of his reign, Cyrus came out of Persia, with a great army, and having already conquered all the rest of Asia, he came hastily to Babylonia. When Nabonidus perceived he was coming to attack him, he met him with his forces, and joining battle with him was beaten, and fled away with a few of his troops with him, and was shut up within the city Borsippus. Hereupon Cyrus took Babylon, and gave order that the outer walls of the city should be demolished, because the city had proved very troublesome to him, and cost him a great deal of pains to take it. He then marched away to Borsippus, to besiege Nabonidus, but as Nabonidus did not sustain the siege, but delivered himself into his hands, he was at first kindly used by Cyrus, who gave him Carmania as a place for him to inhabit in, but sent him out of Babylonia. Accordingly Nabonidus spent the rest of his time in that country, and there died. These accounts agree with the true histories in our books, for in them it is written that Nebuchadnezzar, in the 18th year of his reign, laid our temple desolate, and so it lay in that state of obscurity, for 50 years, but that in the 2nd year of the reign of Cyrus its foundations were laid, and it was finished again in the 2nd year of Darius. I will now add the records of the Phoenicians, for it will not be superfluous to give the reader demonstrations more than enough on this occasion. In them we have this enumeration of the times of their several kings: Nabuchodonosor besieged Tyre for 13 years, in the days of Itobal, their king; after him reigned Baal 10 years, after him were judges appointed, who judged the people: Ecnebalus, the son of Bathlachus, 2 months; Chalbes, the son of Abdias, 10 months; Abar, the high priest, 3 months; Midbanus, and Garastratus, the sons of Abdelimus, were judges 6 years, after whom Balatorus reigned 1 year; after his death they sent and fetched Merballus from Babylon, who reigned 4 years; after his death they sent for his brother Hiram, who reigned 20 years. Under his reign Cyrus became king of Persia. So that the whole interval is 54 years. Besides 3 months, for in the 7th year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar he began to besiege Tyre, and Cyrus the Persian took the kingdom in the 14th year of Hiram. So that the records of the Chaldeans and Tyrians agree with our writings about this temple, and the testimonies here produced are an indisputable and undeniable attestation to the antiquity of our nation. And I suppose that what I have already said may be sufficient to such as are not very contentious. Part 3. But now it is proper to satisfy the inquiry of those that disbelieve the records of barbarians, and think none but Greeks to be worthy of credit, and to produce many of these very Greeks, who were acquainted with our nation, and to set before them such as upon occasion have made mention of us in their own writings. Pythagoras, therefore, of Samos, lived in very ancient times, and was esteemed a person superior to all philosophers in wisdom and piety towards God. Now it is plain that he did not only know our doctrines, but was in very great measure a follower, and that Myra rubbed them? There is not indeed extant any writing that is owned for his, but many there are who have written his history, of whom Hermippus is the most celebrated, who was a person very inquisitive into all sorts of history. Now this Hermippus, in his first book concerning Pythagoras, speaks thus, that Pythagoras, upon the death of one of his associates, whose name was Callipholus, a Croton late by birth, affirmed that this man's soul conversed with him both night and day, and enjoined him not to pass over a place where an ass had fallen down, as also not to drink of such waters as caused thirst again, and to abstain from all sorts of reproaches. After which he adds thus, this he did and said in imitation of the doctrines of the Jews and Thracians, which he transferred into his own philosophy. For it is very truly affirmed of this Pythagoras, that he took a great many of the laws of the Jews into his own philosophy. Nor was our nation unknown of old to several of the Grecian cities, and indeed was thought worthy of imitation by some of them. This is declared by Theophrastus, in his writings concerning laws, for he says that the laws of the Tyrians forbid men to swear foreign oaths, among which he enumerates some others, and particularly that called Corban, which oath can only be found among the Jews, and declares what a man may call a thing devoted to God. Nor indeed was Herodotus of Halicarnassus unacquainted with our nation, but mentions it after a way of his own, when he saith thus, in the second book concerning the Colchians. His words are these, the only people who were circumcised in their privy members originally were the Colchians, the Egyptians, and the Ethiopians, but the Phoenicians, and those Syrians that are in Palestine confess that they learned it from the Egyptians. And for those Syrians who live about the rivers Thermodon and Parthenius, and their neighbors the Macrones, they say they have lately learned it from the Colchians, for these are the only people that are circumcised among mankind, and appear to have done the very same thing with the Egyptians. But as for the Egyptians and Ethiopians themselves, I am not able to say which of them received it from the other. This therefore is what Herodotus says, that the Syrians that are in Palestine are circumcised. But there are no inhabitants of Palestine that are circumcised excepting the Jews, and therefore it must be his knowledge of them that enabled him to speak so much concerning them. Cheirilus also, a still ancienter writer, and a poet, makes mention of our nation, and informs us that it came to the assistance of King Xerxes, in his expedition against Greece. For in his enumeration of all those nations, he last of all inserts ours among the rest, when he says, at the last there passed over a people, wonderful to be beheld, for they spake the Phoenician tongue, with their mouths, they dwelt in the Solomon Mountains, near a broad lake, their heads were sooty, they had round raziers on them, their heads and faces were like nasty horse heads also, that had been hardened in the smoke. I think, therefore, that it is evident to everybody that Cheirilus means us, because the Solomon Mountains are in our country, wherein we inhabit, as is also the lake called Asphaltitis, for this is a broader and larger lake than any other that is in Syria, and thus does Cheirilus make mention of us. But now that not only the lowest sort of the Grecians, but those that are had in the greatest admiration for their philosophic improvements among them, did not only know the Jews, but when they lighted upon any of them, admired them also, it is easy for any one to know. For Clearchus, who was the scholar of Aristotle, and inferior to no one of the Peripatetics whomsoever, in his first book concerning sleep, says that Aristotle his master related what follows of a Jew, and sets down Aristotle's own discourse with him. The account is this, as written down by him, now, for a great part of what this Jew said. It would be too long to recite it, but what includes in it both wonder and philosophy it may not be amiss to discourse of. Now, that I may be plain with thee, Hipparchides, I shall herein seem to thee to relate wonders, and what will resemble dreams themselves. Hereupon Hipparchides answered modestly, and said, for that very reason it is that all of us are very desirous of hearing what thou art going to say. Then replied Aristotle, for this cause it will be the best way to imitate that rule of the rhetoricians, which requires us first to give an account of the man, and of what nation he was, that so we may not contradict our master's directions. Then said Hipparchides, Go on, if it so pleases thee. This man then, answered Aristotle, was by birth a Jew, and came from Celesyria. These Jews are derived from the Indian philosophers, they are named by the Indians Calami, and by the Syrians Judei, and took their name from the country they inhabit, which is called Judea, but for the name of their city, it is a very awkward one, for they call it Jerusalem. Now this man, when he was hospitably treated by a great many, came down from the upper country, to the places near the sea, and became a Grecian, not only in his language, but in his soul also, insomuch that when we ourselves happened to be in Asia, about the same places whither he came, he conversed with us, and with other philosophical persons, and made a trial of our skill in philosophy, and he had lived with many learned men. He communicated to us more information, and he received from us this as Aristotle's account of the matter, as given us by Clearchus, which Aristotle discoursed also particularly of the great and wonderful fortitude of this Jew, in his diet and continent way of living, as those that please may learn more about him from Clearchus's book itself, for I avoid setting down any more than is sufficient for my purpose. Now Clearchus said this by way of digression, for his main design was of another nature. But for Akata of Abdera, who was both a philosopher and one very useful in an active life, he was contemporary with King Alexander, in his youth, and afterward was with Ptolemy, the son of Lagus. He did not write about the Jewish affairs by the by only, but composed an entire book concerning the Jews themselves, out of which book I am willing to run over a few things, of which I have been treating by way of epitome. And, in the first place, I will demonstrate the time when this Akata lived, for he mentions the fight that was between Ptolemy and Demetrius about Gaza, which was fought in the 11th year after the death of Alexander, and in the 117th Olympiad, as Castor says in his history. For when he had sat down this Olympiad, he says further, that in this Olympiad Ptolemy, the son of Lagus, beat in battle Demetrius, the son of Antigonus, who was named Polyorcetes, at Gaza. Now, it is agreed by all, that Alexander died in the 114th Olympiad. It is therefore evident that our nation flourished in his time, and in the time of Alexander. Again, Akata says to the same purpose, as follows, Ptolemy got possession of the places in Syria, after that battle at Gaza, and many, when they heard of Ptolemy's moderation and humanity, went along with him to Egypt, and were willing to assist him in his affairs, one of whom, Akata says, was Hezekiah the high priest of the Jews, a man of about 66 years of age, and in great dignity among his own people. He was a very sensible man, and could speak very movingly, and was very skillful in the management of affairs, if any other man ever were so, although, and he says, all the priests of the Jews took tithes of the products of the earth, and managed public affairs, and were in number not above 1,500, at the most. Akata mentions this Hezekiah a second time, and says, that, as he was possessed of so great a dignity, and was become familiar with us, so did he take certain of those that were with him, and explain to them all the circumstances of their people, for he had all their habitations and polity down in writing. Moreover, Akata declares again, what regard we have for our laws, and that we resolve to endure anything rather than transgress them, because we think it right for us to do so, whereupon he adds, that, although they are in a bad reputation among their neighbors, and among all those that come to them, and have been often treated injuriously by the kings and governors of Persia, yet can they not be dissuaded from acting what they think best, but that when they are stripped on this account, and have torments inflicted upon them, and they are brought to the most terrible kinds of death, they meet them after an extraordinary manner, beyond all other people, and will not renounce the religion of their forefathers. Akata also produces demonstrations not a few of this their resolute tenaciousness of their loss, when he speaks thus, Alexander was once at Babylon, and had an intention to rebuild the temple of Belus, that was fallen to decay, and in order thereto, he commanded all his soldiers in general to bring earth thither. But the Jews, and they only, would not comply with that command, nay, they underwent stripes and great losses of what they had on this account, till the king forgave them, and permitted them to live in quiet. He adds further, that when the Macedonians came to them into that country, and demolished the old temples, and the altars, they assisted them in demolishing them all, but for not assisting them in rebuilding them they either underwent losses, or sometimes obtained forgiveness. He adds further, that these men deserve to be admired on that account. He also speaks of the mighty populousness of our nation, and says that the Persians formerly carried away many 10,000s of our people to Babylon, as also that not a few 10,000s were removed after Alexander's death into Egypt and Phoenicia, by reason of the sedition that was arisen in Syria. The same person takes notice in his history, how large the country is which we inhabit, as well as of its excellent character, and says, that the land in which the Jews inhabit contains 3 millions of Araurae, and is generally of a most excellent and most fruitful soil, nor is Judea, of lesser dimensions. The same man describe our city Jerusalem also itself as of a most excellent structure, and very large, and inhabited from the most ancient times. He also discourses of the multitude of men in it, and of the construction of our temple, after the following manner: there are many strong places and villages, says he, in the country of Judea, but one strong city there is, about 50 furlongs in circumference, which is inhabited by 120,000 men, or thereabouts, they call it Jerusalem. There is about the middle of the city a wall of stone, whose length is 500 feet, and the breadth 100 cubits, with double cloisters, wherein there is a square altar, not made of hewn stone, but composed of white stones gathered together, having each side 20 cubits long, and its altitude 10 cubits. Hard by it is a large edifice, wherein there is an altar, and a candlestick, both of gold, and in weight 2 talents, upon these there is a light, that is never extinguished, either by night, or by day. There is no image, nor anything, nor any donations therein, nothing at all as there planted, neither grove, nor anything of that sort. The priests abide there in both nights and days, performing certain purifications, and drinking not the least drop of wine, while they are in the temple. Moreover, he attests that we Jews went as auxiliaries along with King Alexander, and after him with his successors. I will add further what he says he learned when he was himself with the same army, concerning the actions of a man, that was a Jew. His words are these: as I was myself going to the Red Sea, there followed us a man, whose name was Moslem. He was one of the Jewish horsemen, who conducted us. He was a person of great courage, of a strong body, and by all allowed to be the most skillful archer, that was either among the Greeks or barbarians. Now this man, as people were in great numbers passing along the road, and a certain augur was observing an augury by a bird, and requiring them all to stand still, inquired what they stayed for. Hereupon the augur showed him the bird from whence he took his augury, and told him that if the bird stayed where he was, they ought all to stand still, but that if he got up and flew onward, they must go forward, but that if he flew backward, they must retire again. Moslem made no reply, but drew his bow, and shot at the bird, and hit him, and killed him, and, as the augur and some others were very angry, and wished imprecations upon him, he answered them thus: why are you so mad, as to take this most unhappy bird into your hands? For how can this bird give us any true information concerning our march, who could not foresee how to save himself? For had he been able to foreknow what was future, he would not have come to this place, but would have been afraid lest Moslem the Jew should shoot at him, and kill him. But of Akata's testimonies we have said enough, for as to such as desire to know more of them, they may easily obtain them from his book itself. However, I shall not think it too much for me to name Agatharchides, as having made mention of us Jews, though in way of derision at our simplicity, as he supposes it to be. For when he was discoursing of the affairs of Stratonis, how she came out of Macedonia into Syria, and left her husband Demetrius, while yet Seleucus would not marry her, as she expected, but during the time of his raising an army at Babylon, stirred up a sedition about Antioch, and how, after that, the king came back, and upon his taking of Antioch, she fled to Seleucia, and had it in her power to sail away immediately, yet did she comply with a dream which forbade her so to do, and so was caught and put to death. When Agatharchides had premised this story, and had jested upon Stratonis, for her superstition, he gives a like example of what was reported concerning us, and writes thus: There are a people called Jews, and dwell in a city the strongest of all other cities, which the inhabitants call Jerusalem, and are accustomed to rest on every seventh day, on which times they make no use of their arms, nor meddle with husbandry, nor take care of any affairs of life, but spread out their hands in their holy places, and pray, till the evening. Now it came to pass, that when Ptolemy, the son of Lycus, came into this city with his army, that these men, in observing this mad custom of theirs, instead of guarding the city, suffered their country to submit itself to a bitter lord, and their law was openly proved to have commanded a foolish practice. This accident taught all other men, but the Jews, to disregard such dreams, as these were, and not to follow the like idle suggestions delivered, as a law, when, in such uncertainty of human reasonings, they are at a loss what they should do. Now this our procedure seems a ridiculous thing to Agatharchides, but will appear to such, as consider it without prejudice a great thing, and what deserved a great many encomiums, I mean, when certain men constantly prefer the observation of their laws, and their religion towards God, before the preservation of themselves and their country. Now that some writers have omitted to mention our nation, not because they knew nothing of us, but because they envied us, or for some other unjustifiable reasons, I think I can demonstrate by particular instances. For Hieronymus, who wrote the history of Alexander's successors, lived at the same time with Achata, and was a friend of King Antigonus, and president of Syria. Now it is plain that Achata wrote an entire book concerning us, while Hieronymus never mentions us in his history, although he was bred up very near to the places where we live. Thus different from one another are the inclinations of men, while the one thought we deserved to be carefully remembered, as some ill-disposed passion blinded the other's mind so entirely, that he could not discern the truth. And now certainly the foregoing records of the Egyptians, and Chaldeans, and Phoenicians, together with so many of the Greek writers, will be sufficient for the demonstration of our antiquity. Moreover, besides those forementioned, Theophilus, and Theodotu, and Nicias, and Aristophanes, and Hermogenes, Poihemeros also, and Conon, and Zobarion, and perhaps many others, for I have not lighted upon all the Greek books, have made distinct mention of us. It is true, many of the men, before mentioned, have made great mistakes about the true accounts of our nation, in the earliest times, because they had not perused our sacred books, yet have they all of them afforded their testimony to our antiquity, concerning which I am now treating. However, Demetrius Phalereus, and the elder Philo, with a Polemo, have not greatly missed the truth about our affairs, whose lesser mistakes ought therefore to be forgiven them, for it was not in their power to understand our writings with the utmost accuracy. Part 4. One particular there is still remaining behind of what I at first proposed to speak of, and that is, to demonstrate that those calumnies and reproaches which some have thrown upon our nation are lies, and to make use of those writers' own testimonies against themselves, and that in general this self-contradiction hath happened to many other authors by reason of their ill will to some people, I conclude, is not unknown to such as have read histories with sufficient care. For some of them have endeavored to disgrace the nobility of certain nations, and of some of the most glorious cities, and have cast reproaches upon certain forms of government. Bus hapteo pom pusabus the city of Athens, Polycrates, that of Lacedaemon, as hath he hatrote the Tripliticus, for he is not teo pompas, as is supposed by Zoemi, done by the city of Thebes. Timiles also hath greatly abused the foregoing people and others also, and this ill treatment they use chiefly when they have a contest with men of the greatest reputation, some out of envy and malice, and others, as supposing that by this foolish talking of theirs they may be thought worthy of being remembered themselves, and indeed they do by no means fail of their hopes, with regard to the foolish part of mankind, but men of sober judgment still condemn them of great malignity. Now the Egyptians were the first that cast reproaches upon us, in order to please which nation, some others undertook to pervert the truth, while they would neither own that our forefathers came into Egypt, from another country, as the fact was, nor give a true account of our departure thence. And indeed the Egyptians took many occasions to hate us, and envy us, in the first place, because our ancestors had had the dominion over their country. And when they were delivered from them, and gone to their own country again, they lived there in prosperity. In the next place, the difference of our religion from theirs hath occasioned great enmity between us, while our way of divine worship did as much exceed that which their laws appointed, as does the nature of God exceed that of brute beasts, for so far they all agree through the whole country, to esteem such animals as gods, although they differ one from another in the peculiar worship they severally pay to them. And certainly men they are entirely of vain and foolish minds, who have thus accustomed themselves from the beginning to have such bad notions concerning their gods, and could not think of imitating that decent form of divine worship which we made use of, though, when they saw our institutions approved by many others, they could not but envy us on that account, for some of them have proceeded to that degree of folly and meanness in their conduct, as not to scruple to contradict their own ancient records. Nay, to contradict themselves also in their writings, and yet were so blinded by their passions as not to discern it. And now I will turn my discourse to one of their principal writers, whom I have a little before made use of as a witness to our antiquity, I mean Manetho. He promised to interpret the Egyptian history, out of their sacred writings, and premised this, that our people had come into Egypt, many 10,000s in number, and subdued its inhabitants, and when he had further confessed that we went out of that country afterward, and settled in that country which is now called Judea, and there built Jerusalem, and its temple. Now thus far he followed his ancient records, but after this he permits himself, in order to appear to have written what rumors and reports passed abroad about the Jews, and introduces incredible narrations, as if he would have the Egyptian multitude, that had the leprosy, and other distempers, to have been mixed with us, and he says they were, and that they were condemned to fly out of Egypt together, for he mentions Amenophis, a fictitious king's name. Though on that account he durst not set down the number of years of his reign, which yet he had accurately done, as to the other kings he mentions. He then ascribes certain fabulous stories to this king, as having in a manner forgotten how he had already related that the departure of the shepherds for Jerusalem had been 518 years, before, for Thutmosis was king, when they went away. Now, from his days, the reigns of the intermediate kings, according to Manetho, amounted to 393 years, as he says himself, till the two brothers Cephas and Hermias, the one of whom, Cephas, was called by that other name of Aiptus, and the other, Hermias, by that of Danaus. He also says that Cephas ceased the other out of Egypt, and reigned 59 years, as did his eldest son Ramses reign, after him 66 years. When Manetho therefore had acknowledged that our forefathers were gone out of Egypt, so many years ago, he introduces his fictitious king Amenophis, and says thus, this king was desirous to become a spectator of the gods, as had Horus, one of his predecessors, in that kingdom, desired the same before him. He also communicated that his desire to his namesake Amenophis, who was the son of Pappus, and one that seemed to partake of a divine nature, both as to wisdom, and the knowledge of futurities. Manetho adds, how this namesake of his told him that he might see the gods, if he would clear the whole country of the lepers, and of the other impure people, that the king was pleased with this injunction, and got together all that had any defect in their bodies out of Egypt, and that their number was 80,000, whom he sent to those quarries which are on the east side of the Nile, that they might work in them, and might be separated from the rest of the Egyptians. He says further, that there were some of the learned priests that were polluted with the leprosy, but that still this Amenophis, the wise man, and the prophet, was afraid that the gods would be angry at him and at the king, if there should appear to have been violence offered them, who also added this further, out of his sagacity about futurities, that certain people would come to the assistance of these polluted wretches, and would conquer Egypt, and keep it in their possession 13 years, that, however, he durst not tell the king of these things, but that he left a writing behind him about all those matters, and then slew himself, which made the king disconsolate. After which he writes thus verbatim, after those that were sent to work in the quarries had continued in that miserable state, for a long while, the king was desired that he would set apart the city of Arras, which was then left desolate of the shepherds, for their habitation and protection, which desire he granted them. Now this city, according to the ancient theology, was Tifa's city. But when these men were gotten into it, and found the place fit for a revolt, they appointed themselves a ruler out of the priests of Helopolis, whose name was Osirsif, and they took their oaths that they would be obedient to him in all things. He then, in the first place, made this law for them, that they should neither worship the Egyptian gods, nor should abstain from any one of those sacred animals which they have in the highest esteem, but kill, and destroy them all, that they should join themselves to nobody, but to those that were of this confederacy. When he had made such laws as these, and many more such, as were mainly opposite to the customs of the Egyptians, he gave order, that they should use the multitude of the hands they had in building walls about their city, and make themselves ready for a war with King Amenophis, while he did himself take into his friendship the other priests, and those that were polluted with them, and sent ambassadors to those shepherds who had been driven out of the land by Daphilmasis to the city called Jerusalem, whereby he informed them of his own affairs, and of the state of those others, that had been treated after such an ignominious manner, and desired that they would come with one consent to his assistance, in this war against Egypt. He also promised that he would, in the first place, bring them back to their ancient city and country of Arras, and provide a plentiful maintenance for their multitude, that he would protect them, and fight for them as occasion should require, and would easily reduce the country under their dominion. These shepherds were all very glad of this message, and came away with alacrity altogether, being in number 200,000 men, and in little time they came to of Arras. And now Amenophis the king of Egypt, upon his being informed of their invasion, was in great confusion, as calling to mind what Amenophis, the son of Papus, had foretold him, and, in the first place, he assembled the multitude of the Egyptians, and took counsel with their leaders, and sent for their sacred animals to him, especially for those that were principally worshipped in their temples, and gave a particular charge to the priests distinctly, that they should hide the images of their gods with the utmost care. He also sent his son Cephas, who was also named Ramses, from his father Ramses, being but 5 years old, to a friend of his. He then passed on with the rest of the Egyptians, being 300,000, of the most warlike of them, against the enemy who met them. Yet did he not join battle with them, but thinking that would be to fight against the gods, he returned back, and came to Memphis, where he took Apis, and the other sacred animals which he had sent for to him, and presently marched into Ethiopia, together with his whole army and multitude of Egyptians, for the king of Ethiopia was under an obligation to him, on which account he received him, and took care of all the multitude that was with him, while the country supplied all that was necessary for the food of the men. He also allotted cities and villages for this exile, that was to be from its beginning during those fatally determined 13 years. Moreover, he pitched to camp for his Ethiopian army, as a guard to King Amenophis, upon the borders of Egypt. And this was the state of things in Ethiopia. But for the people of Jerusalem, when they came down together with the polluted Egyptians, they treated the men in such a barbarous manner, that those who saw how they subdued the forementioned country, and the horrid wickedness they were guilty of, thought it a most dreadful thing, for they did not only set the cities and villages on fire, but were not satisfied till they had been guilty of sacrilege, and destroyed the images of the gods, and used them in roasting those sacred animals that used to be worshipped, and forced the priests and prophets to be the executioners and murderers of those animals, and then ejected them naked out of the country. It was also reported that the priest who ordained their polity and their laws was by birth of Helopoles, and his name Osirsif, from Osiris, who was the god of Helopoles, but that when he was gone over to these people, his name was changed, and he was called Moses. This is what the Egyptians relate about the Jews, with much more, which I omit for the sake of brevity. But still main though goes on, that after this, Amenophis returned back from Ethiopia with a great army, as did his son Aamses, with another army also, and that both of them joined battle with the shepherds and the polluted people, and beat them, and slew a great many of them, and pursued them to the bounds of Syria. These and the like accounts are written by Maine though. But I will demonstrate that he trifles and tells arrant lies, after I have made a distinction which will relate to what I am going to say about him, for this Maine though had granted and confessed that this nation was not originally Egyptian, but that they had come from another country, and subdued Egypt, and then went away again out of it. But that those Egyptians who were thus diseased in their bodies were not mingled with us afterward, and that Moses who brought the people out was not one of that company, but lived many generations earlier, I shall endeavor to demonstrate from Maine those own accounts themselves. Now, for the first occasion of this fiction, Maine though supposes what is no better than a ridiculous thing, for he says that King Amenophis desired to see the gods. What gods, I pray, did he desire to see? If he meant the gods whom their laws ordained to be worshipped, the ox, the goat, the crocodile, and the baboon, he saw them already, but for the heavenly gods, how could he see them, and what should occasion this his desire? To be sure, it was because another king before him had already seen them. He had then been informed what sort of gods they were, and after what manner they had been seen, insomuch that he did not stand in need of any new artifice for obtaining this sight. However, the prophet by whose means the king thought to compass his design was a wise man. If so, how came he not to know that such his desire was impossible to be accomplished? For the event did not succeed. And what pretense could there be to suppose that the gods would not be seen by reason of the people's maims in their bodies, or leprosy? For the gods are not angry at the imperfection of bodies, but at wicked practices, and as to 80,000 lepers, and those in an ill state also, how is it possible to have them gathered together in one day? Nay, how came the king not to comply with the prophet? For his injunction was, that those that were maimed should be expelled out of Egypt, while the king only sent them to work in the quarries, as if he were rather in want of laborers, and intended to purge his country. He says further, that this prophet slew himself, as foreseeing the anger of the gods, and those events which were to come upon Egypt afterward, and that he left this prediction for the king in writing. Besides, how came it to pass that this prophet did not foreknow his own death at the first? Nay, how came he not to contradict the king in his desire to see the gods immediately? How came that unreasonable dread upon him of judgments that were not to happen in his lifetime? Or what worse thing could he suffer, out of the fear of which he made haste to kill himself? But now let us see the silliest thing of all, the king, although he had been informed of these things, and terrified with the fear of what was to come, yet did not he even then eject these maimed people out of his country, when it had been foretold him that he was to clear Egypt of them, but, as Manetho says, he then, upon their request, gave them that city to inhabit, which had formerly belonged to the shepherds, and was called of Aris. Whither when they were gone in crowds, he says, they chose one that had formerly been priest of Helopoles, and that this priest first ordained that they should neither worship the gods, nor abstain from those animals that were worshipped by the Egyptians, but should kill and eat them all, and should associate with nobody but those that had conspired with them, and that he bound the multitude by oaths, to be sure to continue in those laws, and that when he had built a wall about of Aris, he made war against the king. Manetho adds also, that this priest sent to Jerusalem, to invite that people to come to his assistance, and promised to give them of Aris, for that it had belonged to the forefathers of those that were coming from Jerusalem, and that when they were come, they made a war immediately against the king, and got possession of all Egypt. He says also that the Egyptians came with an army of 200,000 men, and that Amenophis, the king of Egypt, not thinking that he ought to fight against the gods, ran away presently into Ethiopia, and committed Apis, and certain other of their sacred animals, to the priests, and commanded them to take care of preserving them. He says further, that the people of Jerusalem came accordingly upon the Egyptians, and overthrew their cities, and burnt their temples, and slew their horsemen, and, in short, abstained from no sort of wickedness nor barbarity, and for that priest, who settled their polity and their laws, he says, he was by birth of Helopolis, and his name was Osirsif, from Osiris the god of Helopolis, but that he changed his name, and called himself Moses. He then says that on the 13th year afterward, Amenophis, according to the fatal time of the duration of his misfortunes, came upon them out of Ethiopia with a great army, and joining battle with the shepherds and with the polluted people, overcame them in battle, and slew a great many of them, and pursued them as far as the bounds of Syria. Now Manetho does not reflect upon the improbability of his like for the leprous people, and the multitude that was with them, although they might formerly have been angry at the king, and at those that had treated them so coarsely. And this according to the prediction of the prophet, yet certainly, when they were come out of the mines, and had received of the king a city, and a country, they would have grown milder towards him. However, had they ever so much hated him in particular, they might have laid a private plot against himself, but would hardly have made war against all the Egyptians, I mean this on the account of the great kindred they, who were so numerous, must have had among them. Nay still, if they had resolved to fight with the men, they would not have had impudence enough to fight with their gods, nor would they have ordained laws quite contrary to those of their own country, and to those in which they had been bred up themselves. Yet are we beholden to Manetho, that he does not lay the principal charge of this horrid transgression upon those that came from Jerusalem, but says that the Egyptians themselves were the most guilty, and that they were their priests that contrived these things, and made the multitude take their oaths for doing so. But still, how absurd is it to suppose that none of these people's own relations or friends should be prevailed with to revolt, nor to undergo the hazards of war with them? While these polluted people were forced to send to Jerusalem, and bring their auxiliaries from thence, what friendship, I pray, or what relation was there formerly between them, that required this assistance? On the contrary, these people were enemies, and greatly differed from them in their customs. He says, indeed, that they complied immediately, upon their praising them that they should conquer Egypt, as if they did not themselves very well know that country out of which they had been driven by force. Now had these men been in want, or lived miserably, perhaps they might have undertaken so hazardous an enterprise, but, as they dwelt in the happy city, and had a large country, and one better than Egypt itself, how came it about that, for the sake of those that had of old been their enemies, of those that were maimed in their bodies, and of those whom none of their own relations would endure, they should run such hazards in assisting them? For they could not foresee that the king would run away from them. On the contrary, he saith himself that Amenophis's son had 300,000 men with him, and met them at Pelusium. Now, to be sure, those that came could not be ignorant of this, but for the king's repentance and flight, how could they possibly guess at it? He then says that those who came from Jerusalem, and made this invasion, got the granaries of Egypt into their possession, and perpetrated many of the most horrid actions there. And thence he reproaches them, as though he had not himself introduced them as enemies, or as though he might accuse such as were invited from another place for so doing, when the natural Egyptians themselves had done the same things before their coming, and had taken oaths so to do. However, Amenophis, some time afterward, came upon them, and conquered them in battle, and slew his enemies, and drove them before him as far as Syria. As if Egypt were so easily taken by people that came from any place whatsoever, and as if those that had conquered it by war, when they were informed that Amenophis was alive, did neither fortify the avenues out of Ethiopia into it, although they had great advantages for doing it, nor did get their other forces ready for their defense. But that he followed them over the sandy desert, and slew them as far as Syria, while yet it is wrought an easy thing for an army to pass over that country, even without fighting. Part 5. Our nation, therefore, according to Main though, was not derived from Egypt, nor were any of the Egyptians mingled with us, for it is to be supposed that many of the leprous and distempered people were dead in the mines, since they had been there a long time, and in so ill a condition. Many others must be dead in the battles that happened afterward, and more still in the last battle and flight after it. It now remains that I debate with Main though about Moses. Now the Egyptians acknowledge him to have been a wonderful and a divine person, nay, they would willingly lay claim to him themselves, though after a most abusive and incredible manner, and pretend that he was of Heliopolis, and one of the priests of that place, and was ejected out of it among the rest, on account of his leprosy, although it had been demonstrated out of their records that he lived 518 years earlier, and then brought our forefathers out of Egypt into the country that is now inhabited by us. But now that he was not subject in his body to any such calamity is evident from what he himself tells us, for he forbade those that had the leprosy either to continue in a city or to inhabit in a village, but commanded that they should go about by themselves with their clothes rent, and declares that such as either touch them or live under the same roof with them should be esteemed unclean. Nay, more, if any one of their disease be healed, and he recover his natural constitution again, he appointed them certain purifications and washings with spring water, and the shaving off all their hair, and enjoins that they shall offer many sacrifices, and those of several kinds, and then at length, to be admitted into the holy city, although it were to be expected that, on the contrary, if he had been under the same calamity, he should have taken care of such persons beforehand, and have had them treated after a kinder manner, as affected with the concern for those that were to be under the like misfortunes with himself. Nor was it only those leprous people for whose sake he made these laws, but also for such as should be maimed in the smallest part of their body, who yet are not permitted by him to officiate as priests. Nay, although any priest already initiated should have such a calamity fall upon him afterward, he ordered him to be deprived of his honor of officiating. How can it then be supposed that Moses should ordain such laws against himself, to his own reproach and damage, who so ordained them? Nor indeed is that other notion of Main though at all probable, wherein he relates the change of his name, and says that he was formerly called Osirisif, and is a name no way agreeable to the other, while his true name was Moses, and signifies a person who is preserved out of the water, for the Egyptians call water Moel. I think, therefore, I have made it sufficiently evident that Main though, while he followed his ancient records, did not much mistake the truth of the history, but that when he had recourse to fabulous stories, without any certain author, he either forged them himself, without any probability, or else gave credit to some men who spake so out of their ill will to us. And now I have done with Main though, I will inquire into what Cheerman says. For he also, when he pretended to write the Egyptian history, sets down the same name for this king, that main doted Amenophis, as also of his son Ramses, and then goes on thus: the god Decius appeared to Amenophis in his sleep, and blamed him that her temple had been demolished in the war. But that freed Ephantus, the sacred scribe, said to him, that in case he would purge Egypt of the men that had pollutions upon them, he should be no longer troubled with such frightful apparitions. That Amenophis accordingly chose out 250,000 of those that were thus diseased, and cast them out of the country. That Moses and Joseph were scribes, and Joseph was a sacred scribe. That their names were Egyptian originally, that of Moses had been Bucethan, and that of Joseph, Ptahzeth. That these two came to Pelusium, and lighted upon 380,000 that had been left there by Amenophis, he not being willing to carry them into Egypt. That these scribes made a league of friendship with them, and made with them an expedition against Egypt, that Amenophis could not sustain their attacks, but fled into Ethiopia, and left his wife with child behind him, who lay concealed in certain caverns, and there brought forth a son, whose name was Messene, and who, when he was grown up to man's estate, pursued the Jews into Syria, being about 200,000, and then received his father Amenophis out of Ethiopia. This is the account Cheerman gives us. Now I take it for granted that what I have said already hath plainly proved the falsity of both these narrations, for had there been any real truth at the bottom, it was impossible they should so greatly disagree about the particulars. But for those that invent lies, what they write will easily give us very different accounts, while they forge what they please out of their own heads. Now Mainbo says that the king's desire of seeing the gods was the origin of the ejection of the polluted people, but Cheerman feigns that it was a dream of his own, sent upon him by Isis, that was the occasion of it. Mainetta says that the person who foreshowed this purgation of Egypt to the king was Amenophis, but this man says it was Freedophantus. As to the numbers of the multitude that were expelled, they agree exceedingly well, the former reckoning them 80,000, and the latter about 250,000. Now, for Mainbo, he describes those polluted persons as sent first to work in the quarries, and says that the city of Aris was given them for their habitation. As also he relates that it was not till after they had made war with the rest of the Egyptians, that they invited the people of Jerusalem to come to their assistance, while Cheerman says only that they were gone out of Egypt, and lighted upon 380,000 men about Pelusium, who had been left there by Amenophis, and so they invaded Egypt with them again, that thereupon Amenophis fled into Ethiopia. But then this Cheerman commits a most ridiculous blunder in not informing us who this army of so many 10,000s were, or whence they came, whether they were native Egyptians, or whether they came from a foreign country. Nor indeed has this man, who forged a dream from Isis about the leprous people, assigned the reason why the king would not bring them into Egypt. Moreover, Cheerman sets down Joseph as driven away at the same time with Moses, who yet died for generations before Moses, which for generations make almost 170 years. Besides all this, Ramses, the son of Amenophis, by Mainbo's account, was a young man, and assisted his father in his war, and left the country at the same time with him, and fled into Ethiopia. But Cheerman makes him to have been born in a certain cave, after his father was dead, and that he then overcame the Jews in battle, and drove them into Syria, being in number about 200,000. Oh, the levity of the man! For he had neither told us who these 380,000 were, nor how the 430,000 perished, whether they fell in war, or went over to Ramses. And, what is the strangest of all, it is not possible to learn out of him who they were whom he calls Jews, or to which of these two parties he applies that denomination, whether to the 250,000 leprous people, or to the 380,000 that were about Pelusium. But perhaps it will be looked upon as a silly thing in me to make any larger confutation of such writers as sufficiently confute themselves, for had they been only confuted by other men, it had been more tolerable. I shall now add to these accounts about Manetho and Firmin somewhat about Lysimachus, who hath taken the same topic of falsehood with those forementioned, but hath gone far beyond them in the incredible nature of his forgeries, which plainly demonstrates that he contrived them out of his virulent hatred of our nation. His words are these: the people of the Jews being leprous and scabby, and subject to certain other kinds of distempers, in the days of Bochoris, king of Egypt, they fled to the temples, and got their food there by begging, and, as the numbers were very great that were fallen under these diseases, there arose a scarcity in Egypt. Hereupon Bochoris, the king of Egypt, sent some to consult the oracle of Jupiter Hammon about his scarcity. The god's answer was this: that he must purge his temples of impure and impious men, by expelling them out of those temples into desert places, but, as to the scabby and leprous people, he must drown them, and purge his temples. The sun having an indignation at these men being suffered to live, and by this means the land will bring forth its fruits. Upon Bactris's having received these oracles, he called for their priests, and the attendants upon their altars, and ordered them to make a collection of the impure people, and to deliver them to the soldiers, to carry them away into the desert, but to take the leprous people, and wrap them in sheets of lead, and let them down into the sea. Hereupon the scabby and leprous people were drowned, and the rest were gotten together, and sent into desert places, in order to be exposed to destruction. In this case they assembled themselves together, and took counsel what they should do, and determined that, as the night was coming on, they should kindle fires and lamps, and keep watch, that they also should fast the next night, and propitiate the gods, in order to obtain deliverance from them. That on the next day there was one Moses, who advised them that they should venture upon a journey, and go along one road, till they should come to places fit for habitation, that he charged them to have no kind regards for any man, nor give good counsel to any, but always to advise them for the worst, and to overturn all those temples and altars of the gods they should meet with, that the rest commended what he had said with one consent, and did what they had resolved on, and so travelled over the desert. But that the difficulties of the journey being over, they came to a country inhabited, and that there they abused the men, and plundered and burnt their temples, and then came into that land which is called Judea, and there they built a city, and dwelt therein, and that their city was named Hierosolym, from this their robbing of the temples. But that still, upon the success they had afterwards, they in time changed its denomination, that it might not be a reproach to them, and called the city Hierosolym, and themselves Hierosolymitis. Now this man did not discover, and mention the same thing with the others, but feigned a newer name. And passing by the dream, and the Egyptian prophet, he brings him to Jupiter Hammon, in order to gain oracles about the scabby and leprous people, for he says that the multitude of Jews were gathered together at the temples. Now it is uncertain whether he ascribes this name to these lepers, or to those that were subject to such diseases among the Jews only, for he describes them as a people of the Jews. What people does he mean? Foreigners, or those of that country? Why then dost thou call them Jews, if they were Egyptians? But if they were foreigners, why dost thou not tell us whence they came? And how could it be that, after the king had drowned many of them in the sea, and ejected the rest into desert places, there should be still so great a multitude remaining? Or after what manner did they pass over the desert, and get the land which we now dwell in, and build our city, and that temple which hath been so famous among all mankind? And besides, he ought to have spoken more about our legislator, than by giving us his bare name, and to have informed us of what nation he was, and what parents he was derived from, and to have assigned the reasons why he undertook to make such laws concerning the gods, and concerning matters of injustice with regard to men during that journey. For in case the people were by birth Egyptians, they would not on a sudden have so easily changed the customs of their country, and in case they had been foreigners, they had for certain some laws, or other which had been kept by them from long custom. It is true that with regard to those who had ejected them, they might have sworn never to bear goodwill to them, and might have had a plausible reason for so doing. But if these men resolved to wage an implacable war against all men, in case they had acted as wickedly, as he relates of them, and this while they wanted the assistance of all men, this demonstrates a kind of mad conduct indeed, but not of the men themselves, but very greatly so of him, that tells such lies about them. He hath also impudence enough to say that the name, implying robbers, of the temples, was given to their city, and that this name was afterward changed. The reason of which is plain, that the former name brought reproach and hatred upon them in the times of their posterity, while, it seems, those that built the city thought they did honor to the city by giving it such a name. So we see that this fine fellow had such an unbounded inclination to reproach us, that he did not understand that robbery of temples is not expressed by the same word and name among the Jews, as it is among the Greeks. But why should a man say any more to a person who tells such impudent lies? However, since this book is arisen to a competent length, I will make another beginning, and endeavor to add what still remains to perfect my design, in the following book. The end of Against a Pit on Book 1.
Be sure and visit www.paradisepbc.org, and find many more study resources and MP3 audio files.